Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Last week, we began our conversation with Danny Goldberg. He is the author of In Search of the Lost Chord, 1967 and the Hippie Idea. A little bit about our guest. Danny Goldberg is a longtime music business executive. He began his career as a journalist. The New York Times calls his memoir, Bumping Into Geniuses, My Life Inside the Rock and Roll Business, an engaging, droll, and largely demystifying look at the evolution of the rock trade from Woodstock to grunge. Since 2007, Goldberg has been president of Gold Village Entertainment, whose clients include Steve Earle and Against Me. He is also the author of Dispatches from the Culture Wars, How the Left Lost Teen Spirit. We welcome once again to Common Threads, Danny Goldberg. Hi, Danny.
Hey.
Okay, last week we covered quite a bit of ground. The beginnings of the hippie movement, your personal journey, your take on LSD and what that contributed to the evolution of consciousness, and also how it did become a challenge for a number of people. One of the reasons that you're on this particular show is because, you have a very good chapter on the spirituality, the various spiritualities, I should say, that pervaded that era. And I wanted to talk about that, the first part of this show. By the way, that chapter on spirituality mirrors, to some degree, what is written in the book American Veda by another Goldberg. Are you familiar with
I've Phil? Never met Philip Goldberg, but I read the book and I considered it a fantastic book. And it was one of the sources I drew on in writing my book, and I recommend it to anybody who's interested about the... He covers sort of the Eastern spirituality in relationship to the West over a longer period of time, over kind of the whole 20th century. And it's to me, the definitive book on that subject.
Yeah, indeed. He's a good friend. I'll let him know you said that.
Oh, please. Yeah, I'm such an admirer of his.
Okay. So let's talk about what you know. So you moved out to San Francisco. What did you personally experiment in terms of different religions, different spiritualities?
Well, I always, as I mentioned last week, I grew up in a family that was culturally Jewish. We were not particularly observant. My mother would light the candles on Hanukkah, and we read some Bible stories. I often look back at the book that influenced me a lot spiritually, not only some of the Bible stories, but Homer's The Odyssey. There was a book called The Children's Homer that summarized the Iliad and the Odyssey in a dumbed down enough language that a 10 or 12 year old kid could understand it, and my mom read it to me. And I mention this also because Bob Dylan, in his recent lecture in connection with getting the Nobel Prize for Literature, cited the Odyssey as one of his big influences. So I felt validated in my obsession with that. But one of the things that I loved about the Odyssey was that its protagonist, Odysseus, was always helped out by the goddess Athena. That there was a force bigger than him, and that would overlook him. And also, as a kid growing up, I loved the Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks records about the so-called 2,000-year-old man, which was comedy records, but the premise of it was that this guy had been alive for 2,000 years, and Carl Reiner, as a straight man, asked him, "Sir, what were the early religions?" And he says, "Our first religion is we worshipped Phil. He was the toughest and strongest of us. He could beat the crap out of anyone that disagreed with him, and we respected him and we feared him." He says, "And one day a bolt of lightning killed Phil, and we looked at each other and we said to each other, there's something bigger than Phil." And these ideas, these simple, childish ideas, were always in the back of my mind. I thought there was something bigger than rational thought, than scientific thought, than intellectual thought. But I didn't really identify with the established religions that were available to me at the time, because they seemed to have all these rules, mostly about sexuality or memorizing foreign languages. But it was in the back of my mind. And then taking psychedelics certainly tremendously reinforced the notion that there was something bigger, that there was a bigger universe than just day-to-day external life, that having some sense that there was a life beyond the physical body. And a lot of people were feeling that, and a lot of mystics tuned into it, and in some instances trying to bring some ancient perspective to these feelings, and in some instances trying to take advantage and exploit those very same yearnings. I was particularly impressed by the Beatles. George Harrison talked about Krishna, and so did John Lennon, Across the Universe, and in the album Revolver, the song Tomorrow Never Knows, many of the lyrics were taken directly from the version of the Tibetan Book of the Dead that Leary had published. And I was just sort of attracted in general terms to the notion that there was something bigger. And there was this smorgasbord of Easterners, offering different ideas. And one could go to lectures and eventually, the book that influenced me the most and the thinker that influenced me the most was Ram Dass, whose book Be Here Now was published in 1970. He had taken LSD and given it to many people, along with Leary, when they were both professors at Harvard. He had found that the materialistic world was not enough. After a while, he felt that LSD was not enough because, as he put it, you always came down. And went to India, found a guru there named Neem Karoli Baba, and wrote about it in another book that I recommend. But prior to that, I was just sort of curious, and I avoided anything that felt like a cult. I didn't want anyone bossing me around or limiting my sexual behavior or turning me against my traditions or other people. I didn't like anything that said their way is the only way. I was attracted to people that were more inclusive, but there were some inclusive people. There was Swami Satchidananda, who formed the Integral Yoga Institute, I believe, in New York in the late 60s. He ended up giving the benediction at the Woodstock Festival. There was Meher Baba, whose writings were inspiring. He was most famous for a poster with a one-liner called "Don't Worry, Be Happy," but he was also steeped in the Hindu traditions. A lot of my friends were into Buddhism and liked the work of Alan Watts and Suzuki and other writers about that, and almost everybody I knew for some reason got entranced with an ancient Chinese book called the I Ching, which went from being this obscure academic text to, like, you went into almost any dorm room or hippie party, there was a copy of the I Ching, and that was a way of getting guidance based on the random occurrences of the landing of coins. The great translation that I like, the introduction, was written by Carl Jung, one of the great proteges of Sigmund Freud, who made links between psychiatry and mysticism. And these things were just all over the counterculture. You found them in rock lyrics, you found them in underground newspapers, and the searching for a meaning of life was prevalent. And again, of course, there were established religions that had a lot of wisdom in them, and many people stayed with them. And as I've said in other contexts, to me, the preeminent figure of the time was Dr. Martin Luther King, who very likely never took psychedelics and who was a Christian minister, but himself was such also a mystic, that an inclusive visionary, in addition to being a political and civil rights leader. But for a lot of people, didn't find a home in traditional Western religions. For one reason or another, it had baggage. And so these Eastern religions were fresh and didn't have bad childhood memories associated with them, and were part of the mix for some people. Of course, there were a lot of people that were skeptical about all of it. I dedicate my book to Ram Dass, Wavy Gravy, and Paul Krasner. And Paul Krasner is a proud atheist. Ram Dass is proudly believes in God, and Wavy, I think it leans a little more in the Ram Dass direction, but has got his own way of looking at things. So, I think the hippie world was very respectful of non-mystics, but it certainly gave a lot of space for mysticism to grow, and I think it was part of a lot of the music, and it was part of a lot of the counterculture. And for me, it helped create a context for me for the rest of my life to start meditating and to trying to balance the idea of a cosmic spiritual definition of ourselves, but balanced by ethical requirements in a society with a lot of suffering in them. And that's when I talk about the lost chord, it's about trying to rediscover that balance between activism and mysticism.
So if you know Wavy Gravy, do you know Larry Brilliant?
I know Wavy better than I know Larry Brilliant. I'm a great admirer of Larry Brilliant. I've met him briefly on a few occasions. Don't know him well. His recent book was just a fantastic book. For those that don't know, he was a disciple of Ram Dass's guru named Karoli Baba and a hippie before that, and traveled with the pranksters, took a lot of acid, but also as a medical doctor who ended up being part of the team that eradicated smallpox from the planet. So extremely, extremely compelling figure. But
yeah.
Not somebody I'm close with, although someone I've met and who I admire.
Yeah, he was a guest on our show a few months ago, and just an amazing story, as you say. We can't talk about this the hippie movement or the counterculture at large without talking about the Vietnam War. And it's fascinating how prophetic the counterculture was. They figured out this was a ruse. They figured out that this was a lie. They figured out that this was one of the United States' most immoral acts way before everybody else did. How did that happen?
Well, it's hard to know exactly how it happened, because part of it had to do with the changes in the country, because the Korean War, which was fought in the early 50s, you know, had certain things in common with the Vietnam War. It was a battle across halfway around the world that Americans were asked to sacrifice or risk their lives for, and a great deal of their treasure for, on the theory that it was part of some global conflict with communism, and affected our way of life here in the United States. And I'm not sure that was really intellectually honest about the Korean War either. But by the time of the Vietnam War, the country had changed. There was more prosperity. There was that prosperity gave people a certain confidence. There was a questioning of what had been the Korean War been all about by some people. And there was a political leadership that was really suspect, because a lot of us were in love with President Kennedy. He was incredibly popular at the time he was murdered. And President Johnson, who succeeded him, was responsible for a dramatic escalation. I mean, people say, well, Kennedy started the Vietnam War. Well, yeah, there were like 20,000 advisors there and, you know, maybe a few dozen deaths, which were quite tragic for the people involved. But it was a very small commitment. And many historians believe Kennedy would not have expanded it. He'd been to Vietnam as a younger man, questioned it. Of course, his brothers, Robert and Ted Kennedy, both opposed the war quite soon thereafter. And they were very, very close, those brothers. So I believe that theory. Whereas Johnson, I think, was captured by the Cold War hawks in the foreign policy establishment, who became obsessed with their notion of a global battle. And there were all sorts of incentives to expand the war, both economic and political. And it went from 20,000 people to 500,000 people. I mean, that's a gigantic change in the number of young men. And in those days, there were only males in the army. I think there were 25 million young men who were subject to the military draft, including me and everybody I knew. And the rationale for the war just didn't seem to make sense to us. And President Johnson was not someone that we trusted. You know, he was not, he had marshaled through the Civil Rights Bill and the Voting Rights Bill, which are to his eternal credit, and he's deservedly been given a lot of credit for that in a lot of dramas and books. But he was much cruder than President Kennedy. He didn't have his elegance, the way he presented things, and he was a fierce expander of the war. And a lot of intellectuals and policy people, both in and out of the government, questioned the rationale for the war. The so-called Gulf of Tonkin incident, in which supposedly the communist Vietnam attacked one of our boats, turned out to be fabricated. But that was the basis of the War Powers Act that gave him it wasn't the War Powers Act, I'm sorry, but it gave him the authority to expand in Vietnam. And a lot of the people in Congress, a few, including Senator Fulbright, who was chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, felt that he had been deceived. So there was sort of some opposition to it within the government rather early on. And, you know, I think that it was an advantage, you know, to be just a kid and to look at it in a common sense terms. And a lot of the intellectuals in Washington, many of them Harvard graduates of great accomplishment in other fields, were a prisoner of the conventional wisdom and the pressure to conform, the fear of being called soft on communism. After all, the McCarthy period had damaged the careers of thousands and thousands of Americans only a few years earlier. And, you know, if you were, but for me and my friends, it just didn't hold water. It just didn't seem to have anything to do with the freedom or democracy. The governments we were supporting were not democratic, were religiously intolerant. You had a Catholic minority persecuting a Buddhist majority. You know, you had no sense of any rights of people there, and it was just not comprehensible why we were fighting on the side of these bad people, what it had to do with our security, to millions of people, and to millions of other people. You trust your government. You know, these are the people that are in charge. They've led us through World War II and other problems, and there was a huge divide in the country. But again, it was largely generational. Older people were conditioned to trust the government. Younger people were very suspicious of it. Our hero president had been murdered. Successor was not impressive in the way he tried to convince us to do this. And our lives were literally at risk for a cause that didn't seem to make sense. At the same time, a lot of extremely ethical, serious people believed the government, risked their lives, served, went through great travail, and they deserve a great deal of respect. But I still think that the people in favor of the war were wrong. And today, Vietnam is a vacation destination for Americans. It's one of the safest places in the world. The fact that the North Vietnamese won the war had zero adverse impact on American prosperity, security, or any interests. And the people that were against the war were right. I just can't even understand why there's even an argument about it at this point.
Point taken, point agreed. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella. My guest today, Danny Goldberg. The book is In Search of the Lost Chord, 1967 and the Hippie Idea. If you would explain who the Diggers were.
Yeah, I did give a lot of attention to the Diggers in the book because I think they were a really interesting group, a rather small group of people that were based in San Francisco, became very prominent in the Haight-Ashbury community that we talked about earlier, and then had influence over all of the American counterculture. They all came out of experimental theater, San Francisco Mime Troupe and other groups, and used performance art and theater to make radical critiques, both of racism, of the war, but also of materialism. They believed strongly that they were fierce and rather intolerant idealists that believed everything should be free. They created models of that in the Haight-Ashbury. They had a free food. They were able to get food from the unused food from the supermarkets and create the Digger stew that would feed several hundred people weekly. And they had a free store where it's kind of Salvation Army type of a thing. And they were also very outspoken critics of a lot of the counterculture. They thought that a lot of the political left was you know, too doctrinaire. They felt that the hippies were too spacey. They were sort of the moral scourges of the counterculture, showing up frequently. One of the main Diggers later became a very successful actor. His name is Peter Coyote. In our last time we spoke, you were talking about the preponderance of Jews in the counterculture. Peter's original name was Cohen, and he came from a Jewish family. But the best-known Digger was Emmett Grogan, who passed away a few decades ago but left behind a great memoir that's a good document of the times, and he was Irish Catholic. But the Diggers showed up at SDS meetings, radical political organizations. They showed up on the Lower East Side. They were just invariably criticizing people for selling out. No one was pure enough for the Diggers, and it became tiresome and destructive at times, but it also kind of created kind of a moral standard that informed the community in ways that I think were pretty interesting. And they were very sincere, serious people behind their theatricality.
And they actually existed without using money. Is that right?
Well, I don't think, you know, they literally didn't have money because, but I think they downplayed money as much as they could. They did have these pilot projects that were without money, like the giving away food in the free store, but you couldn't really expand that. As they say, it couldn't scale because, you know, the resources and the infrastructure were not there. But that was the ideal they were trying to hold everybody to.
And ultimately, what happened? Obviously, they're not around anymore.
Well, I think they dissipated. I mean, you know, Grogan became a junkie and died of an OD. Coyote had drug problems of his own, but later became a Buddhist, very much inspired by Gary Snyder, who was a part of the Beatnik generation, a great poet, and a Buddhist teacher. So they went their various ways. They only kind of could exist in the counterculture. There wasn't a context for a loosely knit organization like that to have influence after the counterculture kind of splintered by the early 70s. But in 67, they were a big presence in that seminal year, both in New York and Los Angeles. And their fierce kind of intolerance of the establishment, did sort of affect everybody else in the counterculture in terms of just holding, you know, kind of being a bullshit detector, a moral a critic of it, and particularly in Haight-Ashbury, where they had a mimeograph machine, and they were constantly doing these kind of newsletters that they passed out in the neighborhood. They really were an interesting force.
And on that same note, why don't we talk about some of the most significant people and where are they now? For instance, like Jerry Rubin, he went into high finance, correct?
No, he didn't go into high finance. I think he became interested as he died. I mean, he died rather young. He was hit by a car in Los Angeles at least 25 years ago and died young. It wasn't a suicide, but it felt kind of self-destructive to some of his friends. He became interested in networking and the idea of using some of his, he's quite a charismatic individual, and he became kind of a networker and interested in taking some counterculture notions into the business world. Some people felt it was a big sellout. I knew him at that time, and I felt he was a good guy and was trying to reinvent himself at a different time in America and didn't do any harm. I think his peak of influence was in the 60s when he and Abby Hoffman and Paul Krasner and others were kind of the most media savvy of the anti-war people, and who bridged in some ways sort of the rock and roll hippie culture with the more radical political part of the counterculture. But later on in his life he got involved with some aspects of business, but not high finance, more kind of a lower level entrepreneurial ideas.
One of my childhood memories is seeing him on the Mike Douglas show when John Lennon co-hosted for a week. And
yeah.
and John wanted Rubin on, and Mike Douglas said something about, I understand that you are really opposed to drugs. And Rubin says, well, hard drugs, just hard drugs. And Mike Douglas made this gesture like he was shoving a knife in his own chest, committing Harry Carey, like, oh, did I open up a can of worms? So...
Well, you know, I give Mike Douglas a lot of credit for letting John Lennon take over the programming of his show for a week and for creating a national television forum for a lot of people that otherwise couldn't get on television. He was a remarkable guy. I wish I'd known Mike Douglas. But having said that, I think Jerry Rubin was making a perfectly rational distinction between drugs that were addictive and damaging physically, and the big villainous drugs were heroin and methadrine, the same drugs that today are the scourge of so many people's lives and cause so much tragedy. And contrasting it with a drug like marijuana, you know, regularly on the Huffington Post and others, they'll have a list of here's how many people died as a result of marijuana in the last year, and every year the number is zero. compare it to alcohol, where it's, you know, in six figures, you know, tobacco and prescription drugs. So I don't actually think it was a crazy distinction to make, but, you know, I think to some people, marijuana and psychedelics were outlawed, and vodka and Seconals, sleeping pills and tranquilizers were somehow officially sanctioned drugs, but I don't think there's any actual pharmacological or moral reason to think that marijuana was worse than some of those legal drugs. I think quite the opposite. And I think psychedelics definitely should, you know, Tim Leary and the other thoughtful people were very into them being treated as sacraments in a serious manner and not in a casual manner, with guides and set and setting, and that was not in the end of the day the way most people took them, because it, the illegalization of them just made it a mass appeal. But, you know, I do think there's a difference, you know, and I don't think Ruben was really wrong to try to make that distinction, even if it was flippant.
Oh, I'm not making that point. I'm making the point that poor Mike didn't realize what he was getting into.
Look, this guy was a pro. He was a brilliant communicator. He's a master of television, and he probably did know what he was getting into, and he had to play a part of being the straight guy shocked by all this stuff in order to have credibility with his audience. So my guess is he did know what he was getting into. But one of the amazing things about the Mike Douglas show, as you probably know, is in addition to the fact that it created this outlet for John Lennon and some of the Black Panthers and other people that came on, one of the producers of the Mike Douglas show was Roger Ailes, as a young man who
Yes.
later on advises Nixon and then creates Fox News. So this energy could be used by different people in different ways.
This is true. This is true. Danny, we are down to the wire again, but I want to thank you so much for this week and last week. Great conversations both times.
I can't thank you enough for letting me talk about my book, and I love the work you do, and particularly the interfaith work. That's the savior of our society, in my opinion.
Let's hope so. My guest today has been Danny Goldberg, the author of In Search of the Lost Chord, 1967, and The Hippie Idea. Please join us again next week here on WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella.